to Infinity Podcast as we presented a podcast with our very own local sports journal. I'm John McKay, joined by Jay Gorman, owner of Local Sports Journal, and very special guest Fred Inglis from Shelby, Michigan. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Another beautiful day in West Michigan.
Yep, we're just living the dream over here, and we're just trying to have fun.
Well, Jason, you were really nice to kind of connect the dots with this visit. With everything going on, COVID-19, we don't really want to talk about any of that, right? We want to talk about sports. We want to talk about other things other than that. And you have this connection with Fred. So why don't you, you're going to drive. This is your baby. But why don't you introduce your friend Fred and take it from there.
Well, Fred Inglis, he's from Shelby. He graduated from Shelby in 1995. And, a few years back, but, Fred worked with, KTVU Fox 2 in the San Francisco Bay Area from 1992 to 2014. And, he got to be in the heart of professional sports for all those years. And so I just thought it'd be a great opportunity to hear some of the stories from Fred of his experience around some great moments in sports. So, Fred, great to have you on the show today.
Well, my pleasure, Jason. You know, we've worked together a couple of times, did a couple of stories for the local sports journal, had fun doing that, and I'm going to enjoy this afternoon or this morning having a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, no doubt. So, Fred, I first want to just go back, okay, what year did you graduate from Shelby, and what were some of the things that were happening in Shelby sports back in those days?
I graduated so long ago, you won't believe this, 1967. Yeah,
wow.
I'm that old.
Mm.
Yeah, and Shelby had... I'm older than dirt. Actually, I'm not as old as dirt, but I know the guy who has the patent on it. But Shelby at that time was actually a great basketball time because we had a guy named Jim Darrell who was an All-American out of Bowling Green as our coach. He was actually going to play in the 1960 Olympics but broke his leg and was not able to make it. He was it was strange. Bowling Green University had two All-Americans at the same time, Nate Thurman and Jim Darrell in their basketball program. Jim Darrell came here and really put in basketball, made it very, very, very important. He started the youth program here back way before youth programs were even cool, you know. And we ended up having some very talented players, and we were just we dominated the conference at that time. We had guys with the Beckman brothers and the Griffin brothers. They were Bill Beckman and Rod Beckman were all state players, and they and the Griffins had several big guys. And as long as the Beckmans kept having boys and the Griffins kept having boys, we were a pretty good conference for basketball. And that was about it. We had not a lot of notoriety other than basketball at that time. But it was all good. It was great because I got to play all four sports. You know, I got to play baseball, football, basketball, and I got to play some track. And you played. You didn't just sit on the bench. So I had high school was a very formative time for me because sports allowed me to have some kind of self-awareness and some kind of discipline and some kind of self-confidence. And a lot of the tools I learned from those high school days, I took on into college and into my career. It's just knowing that, you know, hard work, developing skills, and just believing in yourself, those kind of things take you through life. And they're great. They were great lessons for me. And I think, helped me be fairly successful in my careers.
Yeah, so, I figured, you know, especially with the Griffins, you know, seeing those guys go up to the NBA, I figured that might have a little bit of impact on you and your desire to make it to the big show as well.
Well, Paul Griffin is the guy you're talking about. He was back in the I was actually at Michigan State University when they were winning the state championships. Paul Griffin was 6'11" and just dominated everybody in the area. And Paul then went on to play with the at that time, the New Orleans Jazz before they turned into the Utah Jazz. And then he went on and played and made his fame at the San Antonio Spurs. He's one of the Bruce brothers, one of the like three or four white guys that they would just come in and they had six fouls and they used all of them. You know, they just went in there and just smashed and crashed. And he's still around. I see him every year. We actually ended up becoming friends because he would come into the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, when I was there. And he'd come over and we'd meet afterwards and go out and raise some hell. So, he's a good boy, good guy.
How do you go from Shelby, Michigan to the West Coast? Give us a little idea of that chronologically, how you go from being in Shelby and being a four-star athlete in four sports. I'm saying four-star athlete in four different sports. How do you go from that to your broadcasting career and landing on the West Coast?
Well, you know how you get to the West Coast. Just turn right at Chicago. But you know what? I got to tell you the truth. I didn't. I was a late bloomer. I mean, I was one of those guys. This is the late 60s, early 70s. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I got to admit, you know, I was caught up in a lot of that. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I didn't know when I was going to grow up. So I got to be honest with you. I didn't know what I wanted. I graduated from Michigan State University as a theater major, but then I started realizing that, you know, you're not going to make a living auditioning for plays and shows and stuff. And I ended up actually going to Florida for a couple of years as a school teacher, chasing what was going to be my wife. And I hated Florida, hated teaching, hated being married. So I got divorced.
You didn't $600. Hate your wife, did you?
Not this current wife, but I met my current wife down there. That was the great thing. But so I took $600 and 500 albums, put them in a van, and drove to California from Florida, and found myself there in 1977. I didn't know anybody. I had no connection really. I had an uncle that was 100 miles away from the San Francisco area, but I didn't know a soul, and that was pretty scary. But I went ahead and tried to do stuff. I had to get a job right away, so I started bartending just to have cash in my pocket, because that $600 went fast, I guarantee you. And to make a long story short, I floundered around for a while, and then at age 30, I said, this is time for me to wake up here. And I decided to go back to school, got my master's at San Francisco State University, where I developed a program where we actually televised live games of San Francisco State University football, baseball, and basketball. I was not only the creator of it, but I did all of the stories at halftime. There was no commercials, so I needed 20 minutes of video and stories to fill during halftime of football games. Did all of those games and got a kind of a notoriety around the San Francisco area as this young guy who was pretty self-developed and pretty much on his own and got a reputation. But then I ended up taking a job to do, sports. I'm rating the news, sports news, 11 to 6 and 11 o'clock at a TV station in Medford, Oregon for 5 years. Finally, some guys from San Francisco who remembered me from San Francisco State University offered me a job at Channel 2. The was the number one station, still the number one station in the Bay Area. Very, very, very successful TV station. I couldn't be more proud of the station that I was being asked to work at. They asked me for 3 years, kept pestering me. And I finally said, I got to take this job, see what it's about. At that time, I married again. I took my wife from Medford, a beautiful little place, back down into the city. And there we went, 1992. And then they wanted me to be a storyteller. Basically, they saw a lot of my stories that I did, and they wanted me to go out and find a story and fill some time in between commercials. That's what happened, and I ended up being the anchor and sports reporter. But then what happened as well, Fox in 1994 bought into the NFL. That meant that, you know, CBS, at that time, CBS was the NFL network. If you wanted to see, NFC network, if you wanted to see National Football Conference games, you saw it on CBS. If you wanted to see the AFC, the American Football Conference, you only saw it on NBC. CBS and NBC dominated. There was no ESPN. rights to football yet. There was no NFL Network. There was nobody else. Fox came in, overbid everybody, and shocked the world by now being the NFC championship station to watch. That meant we were the NFC champ. We were the 49ers station. That meant we were going to show, we were all of a sudden a legitimate station. We ended up just hammering that. We had a half-hour pregame show. We had postgame shows. We had a Tuesday show. We had, I mean, we sold the hell out of the San Francisco 49ers. So we covered the Niners a lot. And they needed stories. And I told stories about football and 49ers. I'll tell you that. It came out of my ears. You know, this was the Montana, the Jerry Rice, the Ronnie Lott. You know, this was these were the guys, man. They were the Super Bowl champions. I mean, they were every year the chasers. Bill Walsh, the coach of the time, was, you know, the genius of the time. And it was a revolutionary time for football in the Bay Area. The Raiders were there. They had moved out. And then they come back, and now all of a sudden, we've got two NFL teams to cover. We've got two baseball teams. We have the San Francisco Giants. We've got the Oakland A's. I mean, these, if you're not familiar with the Bay Area, they are literally 20 miles apart, ballpark to ballpark. You can't get there for an hour and a half, but, you know, they're not that far apart. And so now we got two NFL teams, the 49ers and the Raiders. We got two baseball teams, the Giants and the A's. We got the Golden State Warriors NBA team. We got the San Jose Sharks hockey team. We got colleges like Cal, Stanford, San Jose State, St. Mary's, Santa Clara, San Jose State. I mean, there was not a problem finding a story. And that's just the major league teams and the college teams. There are high school teams that were doing incredible things that we're covering. There was athletes from all kinds of different venues and different sports that were there. I mean, it wasn't about whether I could tell a story. It was about, could I get a camera? Could I get and arrange the time to interview this guy? We had 30 years of video in the archives. I mean, if I needed video, I had video. But it was all of that logistics stuff, and that was where I had to develop what I called developing relationships. I had to get to know these guys and let them know me so they could trust me enough. And, of course, throughout the years, you know, the more you did it, the more shows or stories you did and expose them on the TV, people started to hear about you, see what you were, trusted you, and all of a sudden then you know, it was a lot easier to call up somebody, call an agent, call somebody up and make connections. And there we went. The thing was, is you had to know your history. You had to know those guys. They had to trust you. And that was what it was all about.
I've learned a little bit of that, not nearly even close to the level that you've done it. But, you know, when you ask to speak with someone, you really got to have something unique and have done your homework. Because if you just hit them with the same vanilla questions, you're going to lose them in the first 2 minutes of talking to them.
Yeah. And believe me, there isn't an athlete. I don't know if there's a person that doesn't enjoy talking about themselves. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You get them to open up. They'll tell you things sometimes they didn't even know they wanted you to know. And there's an art to interviewing. There's an art to telling stories, obviously. You go in with an angle. You have an idea of what you want to do. But if you listen to what they say, the best questions are usually the follow-up questions. I mean, I remember succinctly. You were talking about Jerry Rice, Jason, you know?
Yeah.
Jerry Rice was a pretty shy guy when he started coming to San Francisco State. I mean, he was from Mississippi Valley. And I got to tell you, he was smart. The English language, he didn't have that exactly mastered. And there were times in which he would back off because he knew moving from that little town where he was actually a bricklayer's son to move into the Bay Area. I don't care how great an athlete you are. That can be intimidating when all of a sudden you are so far ahead of everybody in your field. I mean, he just dominated in that conference that he played in. But now all of a sudden, he's a big boy coming to a bigger town with everybody's a great athlete. And frankly, he struggled the first year. You see that a lot of times. I mean, Willie Mays was like that. Jerry Rice was one of those guys who started up, and in the first year, he was dropping more passes than he was catching. And it was like, oh, my God, this guy's a fast player. He's great, but he can't catch.
Can you imagine the thought around Jerry Rice not being able to catch? That's funny.
Everyone's going, what the hell? Bill Walsh went down to that university. He was looking at a different player from that school, and that's when he saw Jerry Rice, and all of a sudden he went, oh, my goodness, and actually didn't draft that guy he was looking at and drafted him, and it shocked the NFL. Who is this guy? I mean, it was that kind of a thing. Yeah. So Jerry knew there was that pressure. He knew that there was that expectations, and he knew he was he wasn't the only star. They were all stars left and right on both sides of the ball. There was an intimidation factor. And you know, when you talk to him, when I started talking to him, I told him about me moving to from Shelby to San Francisco. And I told him, I said, you know, I kind of let him know I empathized and I understood. And his eyes opened up and he all of a sudden realized, oh, my God, this guy knows exactly what I'm talking about, but I'm afraid to talk about it. He talked about it. Jerry relaxed. He calmed down. He was much better. He was much more articulate. He wasn't worried about he was trying to talk that in a way that he wasn't familiar or comfortable or, you know, it wasn't him. I allowed him to be inarticulate. I allowed him to be less than proper English. And he never forgot that.
Jerry Rice played 303 games, 1,549 receptions for 22,895 yards and 197 touchdowns.
You see all these people catching one-handed catches now with those stick-em gloves? Jerry could do that with his bare hand. He was making one-handed catches before it was cool and before they all wore these gloves. So I'm not impressed with these people doing this nowadays. I saw a guy doing that with his bare hands and without stick-em, without anything. Jerry was the hardest working guy. He just overworked everybody. I mean, he developed a regime that other people on the team emulated. People said, how come this guy's excelling where I'm not? And by the way, he got over that drop thing. He started realizing he belonged, by the way, as your numbers indicate. He developed a workouts regime that really hardcore guys all copied. I remember Roger Craig, who should be in the Hall of Fame, first guy to ever have 1,000 yards rushing and 1,000 yards receiving in the first year, in the same year. He followed him. Ricky Waters followed. I mean, there were guys who wanted, you know, Deion Sanders, when he joined the team, wanted to be and tried to keep up with Jerry's workout. They weren't great, successful at it, but they sure got better because of trying to keep up with Jerry.
And Jerry, you know, you look at his size, 6'2", 200 pounds, not in today's metrics really prototypical for a wide receiver. Did you ever interview or get to know Joe Montana?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you look at my man cave down here, I don't have a lot of autograph stuff because when you work in with a sports media, you're really not part of the credential says you can't ask for autographs and stuff. But Joe, in fact, I played golf with Joe. I played golf, a lot of golf with Jerry. And I finally broke down one time. I was actually interviewing Joe after he'd retired about Jerry when Jerry was going into the Bay Area Sports Hall of Fame. And I brought a jersey with him and I said, Joe, I'm embarrassed to ask you, can I, yada, yada, yada. He goes, Fred, I was waiting for you to do that.
That's cool.
So, yeah. Yeah, I knew Jerry. I tell you what, I knew Steve Young probably better. Steve Young was...
Well, you were 95, they won a Super Bowl, right?
Well, you're going to get into years, are you? Yeah.
You were there. You don't have to remember the year.
What year was that? That was against the Chargers that year. Steve Young was playing. He was the quarterback at that time, I believe, right? That was their fifth Super Bowl title. It was the first one where Steve Young was actually the quarterback, if I remember. That was in San Diego. Yeah, that was the year. That was the one that Steve Young threw six touchdown passes in that game. Six touchdown passes, three of them to the guy named Jerry Rice.
Right. San Francisco, certainly. What about the Giants? I know that you had some fairly good interaction with Barry Bonds and all those folks, too. Talk about that a little bit.
Look, people write Barry off because they go, well, he was on steroids. Okay, so let's deal with the elephant in the room here. Barry Bonds was one of the top five players that I've ever watched play before and after the steroids. He was a three-time MVP. He was a five-time MVP, I believe, maybe six-time MVP of the National League. He was three of that before he came to the Giants when he was still that skinny guy out of Pittsburgh. He was a Bay Area guy. He was born and raised in the Bay Area. Dig this. Barry Bonds went to the same high school as Tom Brady. Can you imagine that school's reputation? He talked about, yeah, my high school had some big guys. We had a Paul Griffin. This freaking school had Tom Brady and Barry Bonds to brag about.
Yeah, what's that school out of San Mateo, right?
Sarah High School.
There you go.
Sarah.
Yep.
S-E-R-R-A. Yep. Yeah. And they weren't the best high school team in the area. It was De La Salle across the bay. So, Willie, can I tell you the story of Barry Bonds? I defend Barry more than most people. I mean, people are saying he'll never get in the Hall of Fame because he did steroids. Yep, he did. Yeah. And I'll tell you another. Willie Mays did more speed than any freaking meth crackhead in the world.
And the truth shall set you free.
You know, I mean, those guys in those days, you talk to Orlando Cepeda, who was Willie's buddy and who I got to know fairly well and who's also in the Hall of Fame, by the way. He said, you know, he took a lot of pills, you know, to keep going. I mean, that they were still traveling at times on trains and stuff back then, even in the 60s. And the only way you could play from one day to another and travel and do all that was you took pills, man. You took the Black Beauties, you took whatever. And Orlando one time told me, he says, you know, I thought I had some pretty good stuff until I took one of Willie's stuff. And I got so dizzy, I couldn't play baseball. I was looking at three baseballs coming at me, throwing at me the first base. So Willie had the good stuff, okay? We can talk about steroids and whether that was cool or not. No, it isn't cool. It wasn't. And I will tell you something else. The media was willing to overlook that, including me. I was kind of fooling myself into going, yeah, well, he just gained 20 pounds over the weekend or something, you know. But Barry was a different cat, man. He was a different cat. And if you don't look at the history, if you don't understand where he came from, you don't know where he is today. Barry grew up literally in the San Francisco Giants locker room because of his dad. Bobby Bonds. Bobby would bring Barry to the games. He would play in the locker room. He'd tell you, I used to hang out and one of the Kuiper kids and I would hang out there and we'd play all day in the locker room while they were out playing baseball. So he understood and he saw his dad, who was a great player by himself, on his own, Bobby Bonds. He was a great player. But his problem was he was the guy that had to replace Willie Mays. And he was always compared to Willie Mays. He was never going to be able to meet that standard. So no matter what Bobby did, it was nothing compared to what Willie did. Barry saw that. He saw that all of his life. And he always had that chip on his shoulder, just like his dad did. When he went on to become a baseball player at Arizona State, he was incredible. He got signed as a rookie out of Pittsburgh. He was the MVP back-to-back, if I recall.
No, he was 7 times MVP, 8-time Golden Glove, 2-time batting title, 14-time All-Star, 12-time Silver Slugger, and 3 times he was an ML Player of the Year. Barry Bonds.
All right. Those are numbers that are incomprehensible. People talk about Mike Trout. People talk about guys who are all that, you know. I tell you, a great player was Ricky Henderson. I loved him. I saw him make his major league debut, and I loved him ever since then. But he wasn't Barry Bonds.
And Barry was a lefty.
Yeah. So, okay, 1993. It's actually the winter. It's Christmas time, 1992. I'm at my station, TV station. I got to crank out 10 minutes of sports. And it's Christmas time. A lot of people are on vacation. Very few people in the station. I'm kind of doing everything by myself. And all of a sudden, flash, the Giants just signed Barry Bonds on a Saturday afternoon. And I got to go. I got to be in the station, do 10 minutes of sports. I got to run out there and get ready. He's coming off the plane. I got inside information. He's coming in. He's going to be on this plane. Get there, and you'll get the first ever interview with him. They're coming off, get the reaction, yada, yada. I go out there. Wait an hour and a half, realizing I got 10 minutes show I got to get back to. What's this dude? He better hurry up and come. His plane was delayed. I didn't get the sound. I had to run back. I was so upset. But from the day that he got there, he was, He completely revitalized the Giants. That year, they were going to literally, they were hours, I mean hours away from being the Tampa Bay Giants. They were moving back. They were that close to being gone until a guy named Peter McGowan, who owned the Safeway grocery store business, got 20 people together and bought them as a conglomerate to keep them in San Francisco. They were hours away from being out of San Francisco. It was hours away. Their first thing they did is they said, we got to get ourselves a stud, and they signed Barry, and that was it. All of a sudden, the Candlestick Park was full again. But Barry always had this chip on his shoulder. I remember one time I got there at a batting cage. I was standing behind the batting cage. Literally, at that time, the times were different back then, I tell you. I literally stood on the batting cage as these guys, right next to the manager, right next to, you know, Frank Robinson, right next to Dusty Baker, and leaning on the batting cage, watching these major league players practicing, hitting the pregame hits, you know. And he says, you know, that Mark McGwire, he's starting to hit home run. Who is that guy? What's he doing? Why come him? He's got himself a shoe contract. I don't have a shoe contract. I'm going, wow, interesting. Huh. And I tucked that away. And then I realized, this is a guy who, why is Mark McGwire getting all this headlines? And I'm not. I'm a better player. I'm a 5-tool player. Mark McGwire, he's a home run hitter. He hit 49 home runs as a rookie. Big whoop. I can hit. You want home runs? I'll be a home run hitter then. Is that what they want? You want a home run hitter? Chicks love the long ball? Hell, I'll be the long ball hitter then. I mean, this guy could do everything. That's when I think he turned it around and said, you know what? I'm going to reinvent myself. And that's when he started doing. He joined up with a group out of Riverside with Balco, who were the ones that Balco was the company that developed a steroid that was called the Clear, which was really undetectable by any testing at that time. And that's when stuff happened. Big stuff happened. Jason Giambi was one of the other guys. Then ended up going to Balco. All of a sudden, these guys were looking like Great Hulk, you know?
Don't feel too badly for him. From what I can tell, he made $188 million during his career, and it looks like he's still ranked 12th highest overall ever in Major League Baseball history from an income standpoint. He got more than a shoe contract.
Yes, but he did what he had to do.
Right on.
And I'll tell you something. Now, this is how I got close to him. First of all, I was following him all the time. When he was breaking and setting those records, you know, it was that year that he hit 73 home runs. He was also going for all-time home runs. I was there when he hit his 500th home run. I was there at the plate. We went live. He hit his 500th home run in the bottom of the eighth inning of a game that was the winning home run. We were televising that game that night. Channel 2 was the station you watched the Giants in those days, before those regional sports networks, before all those Fox all these other crazy things like the Fox Detroit and all those things. The only time you could watch the Giants was on our station, Channel 2. We were televising that game. Top of the ninth, I can't even remember who they were playing, went out 1-2-3. I jumped out in front of one of the cameras, grabbed Barry. His dad, Bobby, was hugging him. I go, there they are, the greatest home run father-son combination in Major League history. They hugged. Barry came over, and for 10 minutes live on our station, I was talking to Barry about his 500th home run, what it meant, yada, yada, yada. Then he got to the 600th home run. Had a following for weeks. Before he got in a slump there, he wasn't hitting home runs. So I had to go to every game, on the road or not, trying to follow him so I could be there when he hit his 600th home run. Then when he hit his 660th, that's when he tied his godfather by a guy named Willie Mays. 660 home runs, Willie Mays. So I had to follow him for that level. Then when he hit his 700th, when he surpassed Hank Aaron, I had to travel around for everywhere he went so I could be there the day that he did that. I got a chance to meet Hank Aaron, talk to him probably a little too much because he got tired of talking about it. But, I mean, I ended up being the Barry Bonds gopher, you know.
Past Hank Aaron, who hit 755 on August 7th, 2007, The only other player to hit 700 or more is Babe Ruth with 714.
Yep. And that, you know, that 73 home runs, I don't know if it's going to ever get beat. A single season, 73. Now, again, you want to tell me it's all steroids related? Nobody had a better hand-eye coordination maybe than Ted Williams maybe. But his wrist, his power move, his swing was, first of all, there's nothing better and more beautiful than a left-hander swing in a baseball bat anyway. But he had this stroke, you know. I see guys who are hit 150 pounds hitting a golf ball 320, 330 yards. It's not because of their strength. It's because of their quickness and their speed and their hand-eye coordination, you know. And that's something that steroids doesn't give you. One time, I think he had over 200 intentional walks in one season.
When you look back, aside from Barry Bonds, who were some of the biggest, most exciting visits you had with athletes?
A couple guys. Just off the top of my head, and maybe tomorrow I'll tell you a different story. But today what I was thinking about, remember Gale Sayers, who used to be a running back for the Chicago Bears?
Of course.
He was a Hall of Famer. Of course, he died much too early. I mean, he was that guy at that time. He was the guy after Jim Brown who was everything. He did everything. He ran for 6 touchdowns against the 49ers 1 year. He scored 6 touchdowns in a single game, and they weren't short ones.
The Kansas Comet.
That's who he was. Died much too early.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't think I would ever. I did a series at that time for the 49ers because we had so much, we covered them so much in the 90s that I actually got an Emmy for it. It was called Where Are They Now? And they sent me all around, and I did profile stories on former 49ers from the 60s and the 70s, and they were incredible stories. Those guys love to tell stories. Y.A. Tittle, Leo Nomalini. I mean, it just went on.
You won an Emmy for your series of Where Are They Now?
Yeah, well, yeah. And I also won an Emmy for Barry Bonds. When he surpassed Hank Aaron at 715, I did a half-hour special, and it was all about Barry.
But when you were a kid, did you ever think, you know, you're going to win an Emmy? Like, you know, how did you set goals in life?
Well, look, I never had those goals. My goals were much simpler. You know, I wanted to be warm. I wanted to be able to see sunshine. I wanted to be in love. I wanted to be successful. I wanted to be quote unquote happy, but I didn't know how to get there. I told you, I floundered. I used to speak at a lot of high schools and a lot of things when I was out there. And I always told kids, you know, do what you like and know what you like and be good at it, but do something you like. And that was finally at 30, I finally took that lesson myself and learned that lesson. But don't think you know at 18. I'm amazed. I was amazed when I got into the TV business, how many people in that business did nothing else but TV. They didn't have any other experience in life. They had no other empathy or understanding of anything else in the world. They didn't know what it was like to get your hands dirty. They didn't know like what it was like to sweat. They didn't know what it was like to get under different kinds of experiences at all. So they didn't have a wealth of experiences to relate other experiences to. You know, the old idea, go travel around the world, learn a little bit. It sounds corny, but that's really what people need to do.
And it's before all this technology. It was before, like you said, the ESPNs and the Skype and the Zoom and all the other technology is so pervasive in the broadcasting industry. Man, it was really, you know, grab the microphone with the cords, you know, string the cords all over the stadium before the game, get set up. It had to be a whole different ballgame.
Oh, gosh. And trying to do that on away games and when you had to borrow a satellite from another station on the other side, like when I went to New York. I went to New York to cover the A's and Yankees playoff 1 month, exactly 1 month after 9/11. It was 10/11, and it was the A's and the Yankees in the playoff. And I'm telling you about an emotional time. The city of New York was still reeling. They were in no pain. I went by myself. I didn't have anybody else. I was to meet a bunch of cameramen and a satellite truck from this station in New York, the Fox affiliate there, and trying to get a feed and go live from Yankee Stadium all by yourself with some guys that And you, every other word was, hey, the effing camera ain't effing working. The effing guy back there didn't know how to effing do any. And I'm going, I got 3 minutes, guys. I got to get on, got to get on.
No pressure.
No pressure. Yeah. I mean, that was what. That's why I retired. My ulcers couldn't handle that. But, because then, you know, it's just, oh, my goodness. Oh, my God. And then, of course, by the time,
I was going to say, what prepared you for those pressure situations? You know, you talk about your theater background, and, you know, you got to be able to perform. You got to be able to manage that anxiety of, okay, you're performing.
Well, I think that was it. And I tell you, you know, you move to a new place 3,000 miles away from home with $600 in your pocket and 500 albums. You know what scary is like. You know, I mean, there was no bailout. There was no plan B.
What I want to know is, were the Stooges in those albums? Iggy and the Stooges.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Yeah.
That first one is still a classic. In perfect shape. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. Geez, that's right. In fact, I think I can grab it right now as I'm looking.
Well, just a fun fact to know, and y'all, my brother Steve McKay played sax with Iggy and was with those guys when they cut the Funhouse album back in the day.
Oh, I got the original. That was, I got it right in my hand as I'm talking to you. Iggy Stooge, Rod Astin, guitar.
There you go. The Stooges, man. That's
Iggy Pop. You know where Iggy Pop was born, right?
He's born in Muskegon.
John Cale produced that.
Yep.
Unbelievable. What were we saying? Well, I don't know.
You said 500 albums.
We were talking about you and the pressure moments and how you were able to manage the anxiety
Well, I think fear of failure is the biggest thing. You don't want to look stupid. You know what they say, never let them see you sweat. That was the goal. You had to make everything look like it's, you know, happy time. It's howdy-doody time. It's everybody's, you know, the other expression is you have to learn sincerity. You must learn sincerity. And once you learn sincerity, then you can fake it from there. but it's never given up the ship. I mean, and you know what? I got to tell you, being involved in sports, it's about that. Those are the things I was talking about. One of those things I was talking about when having the experience at a very low level of high school level. I didn't do anything in college, but those experiences in high school, you know, when you're the little tiny 90-pound defensive back and the guy is running and it's either you or nobody and the guy's going to score a touchdown, you got to just hunker down and make that tackle. And it's those kind of things that you learn in those sports. I mean, to bring it back to that, I mean, that's the kind of stuff you learn, that it's, you got to take responsibility. You got to just do what you got to do. That's why sports is so great. It teaches you stuff that you can carry on for the rest of your life.
So, Fred, let's talk about some of the biggest events you covered. I mean, you've been to the World Series. You've been to the Super Bowl. What were some of the events? You know, did you ever go to the Masters? Did you ever cover the Masters?
No. I covered a lot of golf all on the West Coast. I tell you one of the things playoff game, but it was one of the most incredible experiences. One of the ones I always think about was the tuck rule game, the football game. And I want to say, what year was that? 2002. It was the New England Patriots against the Oakland Raiders. That wasn't a Super Bowl game. That was just a divisional playoff game. But, there, you know, some of the events. I mean, I've played, like, you know, that Super Bowl you were talking about, that 49 to something against the Chargers game. That Super Bowl really was incredible, only about achievements. It was not a contest. It was a blowout. It wasn't really a lot of drama. It was the drama. And then that game was, will Steve Young throw six touchdowns? I mean, but that tuck rule game, was had all of the elements of a great story. You know, the old idea with Snoopy and the dog, it was a dark and dreary night. Well, we got there in Boston. We got to the game, my cameraman and I, 2 hours before the game. I remember I slammed the door of our car, and it started snowing as soon as I slammed the door. It didn't stop snowing until 2 hours after the game when I slammed the door shut again. And it snowed. beautiful, big flakes. I don't know if you remember this game, the Tuck Rule game. It was the game in which it led to Tom Brady's infamy, because he was just still, I think just in his second year, he had just taken over as quarterback from Drew Bledsoe.
If he loses that fumble in that game, they lose the game.
They lose the game. It's over. And then who knows what Tom Brady would have been. So we got there, and I mind you now, we flew overnight. We got there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't have a hotel room. I have 103-degree temperature. I shouldn't have been anywhere. So it's all this. The snow is there. The Raiders were dominating that game, but they couldn't score either. But they were just moving the ball left and right, left. And, I mean, there shouldn't have been a contest. But it was still close. When Tom Brady makes that tuck rule, Michigan's Charles Woodson comes around, sacks him, drops the ball. Greg Biekert lands on it. There's celebration. Well, by that time, I was up in the press room, but by that time, I said, well, the Raiders are going to win this. Let's get down there. We got to get down there on the field now. And we were down there. We are standing, literally, my cameraman and I are underneath the goalpost on the opposite end. We're waiting for that game to get over. They're down on the other end, Patriots running the ball. And I'm literally underneath the goalpost stands on the other side when that play happens.
Uh-huh.
They're jumping up and down, and I said, let's go. We ran over to the bench of the of the Raiders. And I'm getting sound bites already. People celebrating Lincoln Kennedy, yeah, yeah, yeah. And all of a sudden things are happening. I mean, we're not hearing the announcers talking. We don't know really what's happening. The players don't know what's happening. All of a sudden they're reviewing this play, and it's taking a little longer. And now I'm a cameraman. I'm saying, roll on this, roll on this. And we're seeing guys kind of, what, huh, turning around, looking at the big screen, seeing what's going on. And all of a sudden they reverse the call, and it's not their ball. And all of a sudden you could feel the air coming out of the entire bench. A heavy feel of, So, okay, I'm telling my cameraman, by the way, there's so much confusion. Nobody notices that me and my cameraman are on the bench. We're breaking every rule, but nobody's noticing because there's just so much confusion. The snow is coming down. I mean, they're plowing the lines every other series, you know, so people can see where the lines are.
Yeah.
Okay. Adam Vinatieri, who was a young punk who's still playing football, maybe he's going to retire, kicks the field goal to tie the game. They go in overtime. Nothing happens. Vinatieri kicks another field goal. They went from winning that game with about less than 2 minutes left to losing it in overtime. And to see the physical, to see their shoulders drop, to see the speed that they're playing with and the frustration and the sense of resignation, it was so dramatic that it consumed everybody. There was nobody that yelled out, okay, let's go, let's get them back. That's one of those things I'll never forget. Then to go out on the field after that and talk to Woodson as he's walking off, he is profanity-laced complaining. I got John Gruden profanity-laced great late. I'm never going to – it was just – that kind of drama is something that you don't get even in some Super Bowls.
And so think about this too. Adam Vinatieri, that first field goal you mentioned to tie was a 45-yarder. So in that weather, in that snowball is what they called it, that 45-yarder to tie the game at 13 that sent it to overtime, and then he kicked another 23-yarder to win the game. And that was the game that began the run of championships for Brady and Belichick.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that was the last game in that old Foxborough, because you could see right next
That's
to it
right.
they were building the new one.
That's exactly right. Guys, I've got to wrap this up, but I have really enjoyed this. I want to do it again. Can we do it again?
If we could find some time again to talk about this stuff, Greg, you got so many great stories.
Oh, I'd love to
hear some of your Detroit Tigers stories. Sparky Anderson, did you ever get to meet him?
Can we count on that, Fred? You want to do it again? You'd be really good at it, obviously.
Of course.
All right. So cool. Let's do that.
Guys, I live in this little tiny town. Nobody wants to know my story, so I kind of...
Well, we do. All right, so let's wrap this up for this week. This is John McKay with Jay Gorman and Fred Inglis. Lots of great stories. We want to keep bringing this to you guys. Jason, what do you want to say as we wrap up this visit with Fred?
Fred, you're the reason why I love Muskegon area sports, greater Muskegon area sports, because we got guys like you that have incredible experiences at the top of the level. And that's what I love about our history here in Muskegon is that, you know, a lot of people write us off, but there's guys like you here that show, like, why I love Muskegon area sports, because we have the best. So, Fred, I hats off to you. I just really appreciate you giving us the time to tell us your story.
Well, I appreciate you guys listening. I mean, this old guy, you know, I'm sitting down here in my man cave, and I got a lot of memories here, and it helps me prevent me from getting Alzheimer's. They kind of help me remember. I used to be busy at one time. Now I'm sitting here just relaxing, my friends. I appreciate your time and mostly your interest. I appreciate it a lot.
No, we'll look forward to doing it again. All right, yeah. That's it. Thanks for joining us on the Local Sports Journal podcast. I'm John McKay, again with Jason and Fred. Check us out. We'll be back with more. Take care, everybody.